In partnership with Kura Wealth, your digital KiwiSaver provider, the NZ Everyday Investor is proud to present News of the Money World, a short show about what's happening in the finance world and how that affects you, the everyday Kiwi. Rupert Carlion and me, Darcy Ungaro, dissect, discuss, and deliberate the latest in money news from around the world. If you'd like to listen into these sessions live, make sure you follow the NZ Everyday Investor on Clubhouse and tune in every Wednesday at 5:30 p.m. Let's make a start now.
So, a big week for Rocket Lab. They finally get their much-talked-about IPO. Yeah. I mean, this has been on the cards for a very long time, but I think now you see space travel as one of the key hot things going around. You've seen Richard Branson managed to raise $500 million last week or a couple of weeks ago, and now Rocket Lab have followed up with their $4.5 billion US dollar IPO.
Amazing.
Or SPAC, sorry, listing.
That's right. So as a bit of revision, because I know we spoke about this on another episode, probably going back 3 or 4 months ago, you know, what is a SPAC? Take me through that again, just for our audience. You know, what is a SPAC, blank check company, and how does it work? Why is it so different from the traditional pathway of a new company listing?
Yeah, so SPAC is when there is a special purpose acquisition company. Yeah. And that is set up by what we call a sponsor. And so for the purposes of the Rocket Lab, it is called the Vector Acquisition Corporation, number one. Yeah. And that was set up by Vector Capital, who are the sponsors of the SPAC here. And so rather than an IPO where it lists a huge amount of paperwork and documentation on the way through, this is treated as a merger. And so this will be a merger of Vector Acquisition Corporation and Rocket Lab. And Rocket Lab will receive cash from the transaction. I think they're based on the high level look I've done, it's all cash that's going on the balance sheet of Rocket Lab to fund their losses over the next 2 or 3 years. And all of the existing shareholders in Rocket Lab will now become shares in Vector Acquisition Corp. Number one, which will be renamed Rocket Lab. And so it's a different way of going about the IPO. It's quicker, less documentation is required, but it also has these things called sponsors, which also mean that they take a huge amount out of the middle. And typically, they can take anywhere up to 20% of the pre-capital raise. So in this case, there were $350 million, I think it was, which was raised for the SPAC at the start. Mm. And so that means the sponsors potentially take $70 million out of it. So not a bad game for those guys as well on the way through.
What's in it for the investor? So if I'm looking at Rocket Lab, I'm obviously pretty excited about that space. I've always dreamt about space. So if I wanted to get some of the action, why is this actually good for me? Is it just really just because it's going to get to market faster and I can actually invest in it sooner than otherwise what would happen?
Yeah, so from an investor's perspective, there's a few things here, right? So looking at it right now, to be honest, there isn't much difference between where it is today and a normal listed business. The opportunity, if you are an investor investing in the SPAC before it's found its target, so Vector Acquisition Corp, its target was Rocket Lab, is you might get options to purchase more, or you might get in early. So in this case, I think the capital raise was done at $10. You can see the share price of Vector Acquisition Corp is already trading up at $11.50, $12. And you've also got the right to pull out. So as a shareholder, if you invested in the corporation, then what you in the SPAC, and you decide you don't like Rocket Lab when they've decided that's what they want to buy, you do have the option of getting out of the transaction. So what it means is there's kind of a huge amount of upside there, or the huge amount of upside potential for the investors through the options, through some of the additional rights that some of those early shareholders get. Plus, you've got an exit clause and the ability to get all your money back if you decide you don't like what they're going to do. So there is some attractive stuff there. And then from a Rocket Lab perspective, the reason they go down this route, it's far quicker and far less documentation, and just allows them to get to market pretty quickly. And when you look at what's happening at the moment in the market, and you look at what's happening particularly in the space market right now, speed will be really important, because if it's going to take them another 2 or 3 months to work through this process with the SEC in the US. Who knows where markets are at? Who knows? They might have had another issue with their rockets, their Virgin Galactic, or anywhere else might have had some issues. And so for them, speed is of the essence here, really. They need to kind of really move quickly to take advantage of the current market conditions.
Agreed. Speed is definitely of the essence with any rocket business, I would imagine.
Well, my 5-year-old was walking into the room, so I was about to try and come up with a rocket analogy there, but gave up halfway through.
Okay, good on you. And we have somebody on the stage as well, the Podfather, Paul Spain, from Podcast NZ, from the New Zealand Business Podcast, and from the Tech Podcast. And I wonder, Paul, because you actually interviewed Peter Beck a while back on one of your podcasts, if you're available, if you're keen to actually share a few thoughts on the actual business itself and what you know about it, Paul, I'd be more than keen to hear your thoughts.
Thanks for having me, Darcy. Yeah, really interesting discussion. I think, I mean, Rocket Lab is pretty exciting company. What you do need to bear in mind is there's a lot of businesses that are working to really compete. But what Rocket Lab have done is really exceptional, and you know, part of that is probably based to on their positioning in New Zealand, where it's been maybe a little bit easier to sort of get, you know, get some things started here. But it's very much a reflection of Peter Beck's sort of tenacity and leadership, I think. And so I think he is somebody whose ambitions will yeah, probably already pretty big to start with, are going to continue to grow. And certainly the sort of, you know, prices that are being, you know, talked about in terms of the valuation for Rocket Lab, suggests that they must have, well, you could say a lot more in the tank, you know, a lot more coming down the track. And so, you know, you are investing that, you know, in on that basis that, really they've got a really, really big future ahead. And I think that's pretty hard to, you know, it's pretty hard to predict, and to weigh up, well, what's the sort of the lead that they've already got worth to them as it becomes easier for others to enter the market. And you could possibly say, well, let's compare the likes of SpaceX and Rocket Lab to the way sort of Tesla have moved ahead of, you know, of the competition. Or you might be a lot more conservative than that. I'd be certainly curious to hear Rupert's thoughts.
I was about to jump in, Paul. Yeah, look, I don't know much about Rocket Lab, but looking at the numbers very, very quickly, what they're saying is expecting $1 billion in revenue by 2026, positive cash flows in 2024. They haven't given detailed forecasts, or at least not in the high-level documentation that I've looked at. However, what I would say is, and this is based on very, very limited or zero knowledge. I think you need to look at a thing like Rocket Lab. It's either going to be amazing, and $4.1 billion is going to look like an absolute steal, or it's going to look really expensive and go to zero. And I think you, when you look at the technology that they're developing, the fact that they've been able to beat the likes of the big, the Boeings, the Elon Musks, those kind of guys at this game, you do think actually, yep, they've got something pretty special. And if it does turn out to be truly special, 4.1 billion will look super cheap. Or the alternative is one of the other big guys catches them, takes over, and goes for it. So something like this, I kind of go, yeah, to me, the number doesn't seem that high, and it doesn't seem that big. But in saying that, it's probably one of those where you're hoping to make 5 to 10 times your money, or it's going to go to zero. It's a little bit like the Tesla story of 5 years ago. There's not much in between ground.
I think it's interesting as well. Like, there's a quote that I'll read out here. I pulled from a NewsHub article when I think it was in March when this was announced. And Peter Beck is quoted as saying, "New Zealand has incredible entrepreneurs, engineers, and scientists, but we don't think big enough. Lack of scale in our thoughts and our capital hold back our incredible entrepreneurship." And I think that's pretty profound. And coming from, you know, like being in New Zealand, watching one of our own from the South Island kind of make it and aim for something, literally aiming at the stars and beyond, there is this sense that, well, how could something that big actually come from our country? I don't know if that's a common thought that others might feel, but I know that surely there's probably the thought that goes on in the back of our head that, you know, we're just little old New Zealand here. How could we actually aim that far ahead? But I think going back to that number, that, you know, 4.1 billion, that is a massive number. It's either very cheap, it's very high, depending on what perspective you think on. But you have to think the thought before you actually see the reality. And he's clearly got a awareness in that space. And he's aware of the type of thinking that needs to happen before the action actually takes place. But it's this point in the market, I guess, where you can attract funding to achieve big goals. And it's pretty cool to actually see that he's out there doing it.
Oh, it's awesome that he's out there doing it and he's got the huge goals. I don't think it's a big number though, right? I mean, I look at like a Rivian, the electric, the EV ute company that hasn't even started making cars yet. That's currently valued at $30 billion. And so again, a place of zero knowledge, to me, four seems pretty cheap. If they actually achieve their goals and if they keep on putting rockets up, the technology they're delivering, that's why I kind of go, I don't think it is a big number. From a New Zealand perspective, it is, but not from an American perspective. I actually heard a talk from Peter Beck once bemoaning the New Zealand startup and investor ecosystem, where he just said, look, when he kind of went and told the story to all of his in New Zealand, he just got zero traction. So that's why they got a few New Zealand investors on early, but very early had to go offshore, because as you've just said, they struggled to sell the story in New Zealand. No one could believe or understand how could a New Zealander go to space. And actually, how could they kind of leave a company like this in control by a New Zealander? And the New Zealand investors just couldn't buy it. That's why he had to go really early offshore.
Yeah, I don't have too much, qualms with their goals. Like, you know, I think New Zealanders can be very capable. And you know, we see some similarities in Australia. Small. Things that start small that end up really dominating on a global basis, and I don't see there being a small potential, but there's just that unknown factor of what will happen with all of these other players that are trying to also enter the market. How fragmented does the market end up becoming as it gets easier and easier to put things into space. That said, you can imagine that NASA isn't going to want to work with 10, 20, 50, 100 different companies either, and a lot of other players are more likely to bet on a safe, stable option, which is really what Rocket Lab, they've built an incredible reputation. It seems that the very, very large majority of what they do, they succeed at, and they move pretty quickly. I think they've been moving maybe certainly sort of slower than, and this is certainly not unique to Rocket Lab. This idea that they would be doing weekly launches. We're not really at that sort of pace yet. We have seen that they've able to produce dozens of rockets, and there are a lot of good signs there. And they've got so many more runs on the board, just about anybody else, basically, other than SpaceX. But there are a few years off from launching, a larger rocket that competes with, SpaceX and a couple of the other players in the US market, and I guess in other markets such as China. Yeah, I would imagine whatever they put their hand to, they can do. I think the unknown is how many players come into the market, and then how much money are people going to spend on putting stuff into space? I mean, it's kind of a whole new territory. With SpaceX putting up these satellites for Starlink, which provides global access to the internet to basically anybody on Earth. That one project that SpaceX are doing.
will more than double the number of satellites that exist in space. So we're seeing this incredible ramp up in terms of activity in space and the number of satellites up there. But I'm not sure of anyone who's got a really clear view on how many satellites are going to be launching, you know, annually. Is it going to be 10,000 a year? What are those numbers going to look like? Is it going to keep ramping up? How much space is there in orbit without things crashing into each other? There's certainly a bunch of complexities there.
Do you think they're closer to answering some of those complexities? Because I hadn't even thought about that as a risk, that all of a sudden it does actually need to turn back to a governmental issue because getting control of everything up there.
Yeah, look, I mean, I think as things progress, a chunk of these things get worked out, and there's certainly been work going on, you know, satellites that can go around and sort of, you know, clear up. There's a lot of space debris at the moment, you know, thousands and thousands of pieces of space debris that can cause problems. So yeah, there's a chunk of things to address. And you know, I haven't had a look through to see, you know, what level of detail are they putting out there in terms of what all the risks are. Is there an offer document you've been through, Rupert?
There will be an offer document. I haven't been through it though, unfortunately. But if you Google Rocket Lab merger with Vector Capital, they will have all of the documentation was there. The merger was approved last night, which means that all of the full-blown documentation is out there. And I'm sure it will have all of those risks. Unfortunately, the US documentation is not always the easiest to get through. It's very, very dense and heavy on risks rather than upsides.
Do you guys know what, either one of you kind of have a feeling for what this actually is? Like, you know, I live on Earth, but this is something that's happening in space, right? You know, space, the final frontier. There's a whole bunch of stuff going on there. I kind of get the fact that Starlink, you know, there's a whole bunch of satellites, communication, internet everywhere in the world. I get that some people might pay a lot of money to go for a zero gravity experience and do a brief stint in space. I kind of understand some military parts to this as well. But what really is like the point, right? Apart from maybe trying to go to Mars, why are we going to space? And is this actually a market that investors should actually be thinking about as in the same way as other markets here on planet Earth? Do you guys have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I'm not clear on how big that the market is, but I think because it's becoming more accessible, more democratized, you might say, it's going to be a lot easier for, you know, even down to sort of individuals to, but certainly smaller businesses to put up their own satellites. New Zealand's got a satellite going up to measure carbon emissions that we're involved in. And there's just going to be all these new ideas. Yeah. You could, to a degree, you could think of it as, think of all the things that the internet has brought and, you know, most of those things you couldn't actually have imagined at the beginning, or even just going back, say, 10 or 11 years here in New Zealand before we had the, fiber to premises. We didn't know how we were going to use it. And it's a little bit like that. If we look 10 years out, there's going to be all sorts of things. Some of them we can sort of predict and realize, oh, a satellite can do this, it can do that. We could have live satellite views of every part of New Zealand and high resolution and detail, and we can think of how AI might use that for good or for bad and so on. So there's all sorts coming. What's unknown is as to what level does that go, and we're how deep are the sort of the pockets of US government? They'll be wanting to spend money. I know that China is moving pretty quickly. I mean, there's certainly talk about sort of mining of asteroids. There are so many possibilities, but how do you actually put numbers on those things and work out what sort of money that Rocket Lab could make on those? Oof, that's pretty hard. But if you look at some of the amounts of money that are getting spent with, you know, just SpaceX for instance, or any of the NASA type projects, quite regularly billions of dollars do go into you know, into those particular projects. So there will be a big chunk of money, that's for sure.
I guess it's kind of like the internet. It's like blockchain technology. Space is just another one of those things where we have a new frontier, yeah, a new place, but we don't really know always what the use case is at the start, do we?
Oh, completely. And you got to remember the use case for a lot of this stuff. I think the use case for a lot of the stuff has been there for a long time around the scientific uses, the communications uses, but it's just been prohibitive from a cost perspective. And what this does, and companies like Rocket Lab, SpaceX, they're bringing that cost down. So a huge amount of stuff that we currently do, I can see a lot of it moving into space and a lot of it happening. And as the costs keep on falling, more and more and more will get there. It's only a matter of time, right? Which I find fascinating, and yeah, to see where it goes.
Let's kind of, in an attempt to kind of change subject a little bit, I'm not quite sure how to make a transition between rockets and financial advice, but shall we give it a crack, shall we?
Actually, if we're talking financial advice, all we'll say is every single thing that we've said about Rocket Lab is not financial advice.
There we go.
Not a recommendation. And please do your own research and ignore every single thing that all of us have said.
Fantastic.
So as my disclaimer said, so look, financial advice. So there was an interesting report. Russell, who are one of the large global asset managers, do a report every year talking about the value of financial advice. And this was released earlier or last week. And as per usual, this year it said the value of advice was around 5%. And so they've kind of done a whole lot of spurious pieces of analysis to show that advice adds value. And the value of advice on a medium-term portfolio, they believe, is about 5% per year. And really, it makes a lot of sense to me. I'm biased. I'm a big believer in financial advice, so I would say that. But at the end of the day, the two things that advice is doing, and this is where this report comes out so clearly, is it is helping people understand their risk tolerance and setting themselves up for a decent risk tolerance. And it is also providing a sounding board and someone to talk to when you're about to give into your instincts and changing your portfolio. So if middle of COVID, changing a KiwiSaver fund from growth to conservative, if you'd spoken to an advisor, they would have kind of hopefully talked you off the cliff and stopped you doing it. And it's those kind of things that gets to. And I think for us in the market, we kind of understand these points, and we spend a lot of time trying to enunciate the value of advice, enunciate to both regulators and clients why advice is important, and it is worth paying for. So it is nice when we see these reports that actually can quantify it and agree with us.
Yeah, and I think that, like, I've got an episode coming out on Monday with the Financial Markets Authority, and we're talking about advice as well. And that's why I immediately got drawn to this. And I'll put a link in the notes for anyone who's actually keen to put themselves through, I don't know how many pages it is of this report, but you can kind of see the whole story probably in the third page of it, where it talks about effectively the five main components. I won't go into them, but the one that I saw that was really interesting, where there was, so effectively we're dealing with 5%, so 5% better rate of return if you receive financial advice. I'm kind of summarizing and I'm probably butchering it there, but they're saying basically that around 2% is in the behavioral coaching aspect of providing financial advice, which I think is really interesting because it's not that common to find people who really get the value of speaking to a financial advisor. And when they do, usually they equate it into, well, I'm going to speak to somebody who's smarter than me and they'll tell me what to do because they're smart. And that's kind of what most people kind of assume an advisor does. But the behavioral coaching aspect of it, if that accounts for 40% of that 5% extra return, that's actually quite profound, because that's a 2% return just based on talking to someone who's helping you to make good decisions, which is more along the lines of psychology than it is around analysis. And that is really interesting, because it's not something that, you know, just financial advisors do. It's probably what a lot of professionals do who provide advice, whether it's medical advice or accounting advice, tax advice, whatever it is. But it is absolutely true. Like, I know with the clients that I meet with and I'm talking to, especially those that are self-directed DIY investors, it is so crucial, I think, to somehow find a way to get advice while you're going it alone. It's now more easy than ever to interact with financial markets with, you know, technology advances. Yet it's also easier to leave the advice behind. But clearly it adds value. And if you can access it, you should. But this is really interesting because it's not like a debate between active management and passive management. This is more, do you go it alone completely or do you occasionally get advice? And clearly it points to the value of advice.
Yeah. On the behavioral and psychology piece, we've got a case study that will come out in the next week or two. But where we have funded, we've got, it's quite interesting, right? We've got a client, we've got two clients, husband and wife. The wife took the model portfolios that we gave them and hasn't touched them since she joined us 18 months ago.
Yeah.
Comparing that with the husband who took the built his own and he's chopped and changed and made a whole lot of changes on the way through. And as you'd expect, or sorry, not as you'd expect, but the wife has done materially better. But that's because what the husband kept on thinking was, well, I think the markets are about to fall, or, oh no, the markets are falling, I need to do this. And again, what's beautiful about investing and portfolio theory and advice, and this might be letting the cat out of the bag, it is extremely simple. The rules do not change, and the rules haven't changed for about 50 years. And it's fundamentally, you assess risk, you construct a portfolio according to that risk appetite, and then you just have to make sure that your client sticks to that risk appetite. Mm-hmm. And sticks to that strategy on the way through. Mm-hmm. And it's such a simple strategy, and it's such a simple process, yet creates so much value for the clients. But unfortunately, because it's so simple, people struggle to see the value in it. And our case study is a really good kind of enunciation of that exact value. And here you're seeing it again in that Russell report.
That's right. Creating a plan is part of it. Sticking to the plan is the next part of it, right? And that takes time and consistent input. That's cool. Well, we have 2 minutes to spare. This is amazing. We're actually finishing on time for a change, Rupert. But before we finish up, is there any other thoughts that you want to leave us with on this beautiful Wednesday evening?
No, all I would say is good luck and we're to everyone in their bubbles. I hope that they're doing well. Actually, one thing we haven't touched on, which is going to take me over slowly, a question that we've been getting a little bit and a few people is, what does this lockdown mean for your investments and mean for your KiwiSaver? And I'll answer really quickly.
Yes, please.
Nothing much.
Good answer.
The KiwiSaver, if you've got a KiwiSaver, anywhere between 60 to 80% of that should be offshore. And this is just a normal part of what's happening offshore at the moment. So definitely not something to worry about. And even the domestic economy, the domestic share market has very little exposure to retail or travel and hospitality, which are really the sectors that will be hit by a prolonged downturn. So fundamentally, I struggle to see this lockdown, even if it's extended for 4, 6, 8 weeks, which based on today's case numbers looks increasingly likely. I struggle to see it having much impact at all. And if it does, it's likely to be short term. So please stick to your strategies and don't do anything about it.
Thank you. That's awesome. Thanks for that, Rupert. Diversification, right? That's one of the reasons why we do it. So that's
exactly.
Yeah.
I like hearing that advice because I didn't necessarily have that advice in advance of other changes in the market previously and may not have always made the best call. So, I think generally a lot of wisdom to that approach.
Awesome. Thanks, Paul. Hey, before we let you go, Paul, I know that you did just on the topic of Rocket Lab again. I can't remember which podcast you had Peter Beck on, but if people want to do a bit more of a deep dive into that and listen to the interview that you did with him, where can they find that?
Okay, so I've interviewed him probably on a few different occasions. Probably the most detailed one was on the New Zealand Business podcast. So that's probably the place to look. We sat down in their I've gone blank on names. The room where they
Mission Control.
Mission Control.
There we go.
So we sat down at Mission Control and recorded that one. So well worth a listen. Yeah, I think it's always good to do that research on the founders and understand about the people behind these businesses, because it's really how capable they are that's going to give you some insights into what the next stage of their business will look like. And I think you've got to look very closely at Peter Beck to get a picture of how Rocket Lab are likely to do.
That's cool. Well, I'll find that podcast. I'll put a link in the notes so that people can find it really easily. That's awesome, guys. Well, thanks very much, and we'll catch you next time.
Awesome.